Oh, welcome yet again. Topic for this one is the mandala of the five Buddhas. It's a key doctrine in the theory of the Vajrayana and a good example of a simple as possible mandala. So mandala. What is a mandala? It's a Sanskrit word that means circle. And there are mandalas everywhere. Mandala coloring books. A lot of artists like to do mandalas because you got a circle and then a geometric figure of some sort. So a lot of variations. In Hindu and Buddhist Tantra, mandalas are used for specific purposes. Usually, you have a square inscribed in the circle. And sometimes, as in the mandala for Vajrayogini, it's a hexagon. And sometimes, as in the Hindu Sri Yantra, you've probably seen it, has a bunch of descending triangles interlocked. But for the most part, you're talking about a squared circle. The mandala on the first page is a good example, again, of a simple as possible mandala. You've maybe seen the mandala for the Kala Chakra. It's extremely elaborate, but it's based on the same principle, a four square inscribed in a circle. Now here we have five Buddha figures in an array, and in a way they represent the five different primary manifestations of Shakyamuni Buddha. The key item in a mandala is always the center, and it's not so clear here, but in the more elaborate mandalas, what you've got is the ground plan of a palace with the deity in the center. And then the palace's gates and even the door lintel are in the flat surface. So really you're talking about a three-dimensional figure. And here those five Buddhas are all standing upright on the little triangles that make up part of the square. So the flat image is just a reflection of the three-dimensional image of a full mandala. So really it's a cube in a square. I mean a cube in a sphere rather than a circle, square in a circle. The central Buddha is white, resplendent white light. His name is Vairochana, which means the radiant, and that represents the core enlightenment of Shakyamuni Buddha. And then the outer four are reflections of various aspects of his manifestation. You always start at the east gate. The east gate is at the bottom, and that has the blue Buddha in it. His name is Akshobhya, which means unshakable. And Akshobhya is a transmutation of hatred into wisdom. So the function of Akshobhya is to clearly see everything that that comprises the reality clearly without distortion. The transmutation of hate is called the wisdom of the clear mirror. Then we can go to the southern gate, and there's the yellow Buddha called Ratnasambhava. And Ratnasambhava carries a jewel in his a palm. And in fact, his name means jewel-born one. So he's a lot mellower than Akshobhya. His transmutation is transmuting pride into equanimity. So in order to reduce the pride, one can chant the mantra of Ratnasambhava or contemplate the figure of Ratnasambhava. Now, up above in the West Gate is Amitabha, considerable devotions are done for Amitabha, both in China and Japan, Namo Amida Butsu, as well as in Tibet. And Amitabha represents the transmutation of greed into the discriminating wisdom. Then in the north is Amoga City. He transmutes envy and jealousy into action. So his name Amoga City means unobstructed success or unobstructed powers. And then, having visited the four outer Buddhas, then we go to the center of the mandala. And there is Vairochana. He has a golden wheel in his hand. And his hands are in the gesture of turning the wheel of the Dharma, of Dharma teaching mudra. So that's the five of them in short. Now to...
Can I ask you?
Yeah.
The very first one is transmuting hatred.
Hatred into clarity.
Clarity, okay. Light.
Into light, yeah, into consciousness.
Mm. And the central one?
Is Vairochana.
And what does that transmute?
Ignorance into wisdom. And the wisdom associated with Vairochana is the Dharma Dhatu wisdom. I think it would do to read a bit out of this. This book is what I got a lot of this material out of. It was written by a member of this of the Buddhist Order of the West, which exists in Britain. And it was some early Western Buddhists that formed this order. I don't know much about it, but it's been around for a long time. And this particular description of the five Buddhas was written in a retreat center in Spain, apparently very remote. He mentions the muddy road and the precipices getting in and out of the place. So it was way back in the woods somewhere. And this is where this book was written, and it's actually quite good. So I'll read a little bit about the four Buddhas leading up to Vairochana. Akshobhya held up the crystal mirror of wisdom to show us the truth of things, to let us see ourselves as we really are, undistorted. Then he tapped the earth to remind us that we shall find the truth not in our ideas about things, but in direct experience. However, the clear vision of Akshobhya could have been a little cold, a little hard. So Ratnasambhava gave us the jewel of beauty. He taught us to appreciate the beauty in nature, in the arts, in other people, in ourselves. He inspired us to mine within ourselves for the beauties of the Dharma and to share them with others. Then, lest we lose ourselves forever in gazing into Ratnasambhava's jewel, Amitabha gave us a red lotus. He held out to us the soft, open flower of love and compassion, so that we began to open out to others, to soften our hearts, and see the unique value of every living thing. Finally, with a mere gesture of his right hand, Amoga City bestowed on us the gift of fearlessness, to venture into the world energetically helping all beings. More than that, he gave us the courage to enter the center of the mandala, to gaze upon the center of existence, the luminous emptiness. So that's some idea of who the five are. You notice they have very distinct features one from the other. Now there's another wrinkle. You can turn the page and have a look there. What goes on with these correspondences is a feature of archaic and medieval thinking. It's to be found practically everywhere in the old dispensations. The idea is you take a numerical figure, say 5 in this case, and you link it to all other groups of 5 with varying amount of relevance depending. The association, it's very similar to Jung's synchronicity, which he calls an acausal connecting principle. In that case, it's events happening at the same time are linked some way. In this case, what's linked is the attributes of a given list of things. One of the most notable is the 10 sefer of the Kabbalah. It has a very large series of correspondences that make the whole web of meaning. Another example that blew me away, since it was the first time I ever encountered that, what you could call the law of correspondences or the law of analogy. Gold is the metal of the sun because they have the same color, that sort of reasoning. In this case, I was writing a paper on the Wedjut eye of ancient Egypt. The eye with feet, you've probably seen it in the Egyptian art. And this eye with feet is an emblem of the third eye. There's an equation that says the light equals fire equals cobra equals the eye. So with that set of correspondences, the figure of the Wedjut eye went everywhere in the Egyptian mythology. And I couldn't find any end to it. I couldn't find any boundary. It was it extended everywhere through this series of associations. By the same token, one of the reasons the 5 Buddhas are so relevant in the Tantra is it's a first example of how this web of meanings is constructed. And the rest of this paper and this talk is basically about the different correspondences, the different associations with these 5 Buddhas. So to start with the imagery symbolism, these pictures come off the web. Vairochana is colored white, and his direction is the center. Now, as I mentioned, the mudra is the Dharma chakra turning the Dharma wheel, the teaching mudra. And it's like this. It's actually a fairly difficult one to make. The others are simpler. And then the Akshobhyan mudra is touching the earth with the tip of the right palm. And the association behind that is at the time of his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, when he was in the middle of the night and about to achieve the full enlightenment, Mara the evil one showed up and challenged his right to be there. He said, you know, you come from the worlds above, you have no right to be on this earth. You know, this is my earth, right? And in response, he touched the earth with his palm, with his hand, in order to indicate that the earth bared witness. The earth arose and then bared witness to the fact that he had every right to be there on the Bodhi mandala. So that's the earth-touching mudra. Then Ratnasambhava, the jewel-born one, has the Varada mudra, the mudra of generosity, and holds a jewel in his palm. The Amitabha mudra is the standard meditation gesture, with the hands folded together and the thumbs touching, or barely touching. And then the Mogasiddhi has the fearlessness mudra, which just raises the palm, and that dispenses fearlessness and encouragement for people on the path. Now, oddly enough, there is another association with those five mudras with the Om Mani Padme Hum that we chant all the time. I got this from the Summit Lighthouse. The teacher there demonstrated this set of mudras, and I liked it, so I learned it. And you just take the syllables of the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, and link them to the mudras. So you have Om touching the earth, Mani giving the jewel, Padma meditation lotus, Hum fearlessness mudra. So and then to add the Dharma Chakra mudra, you say Hri, which is the seed syllable of Chenrezig and Amitabha. So Om Mani Padme Hum Hri, and Om Mani Padme Hum Hri. It's a very nice succinct succession of mudras. And this is the kind of thing that Tantra does a lot. But since I got it in public space, I'm not too worried about revealing secrets that needn't be revealed. Okay, that is the mudras. And then the next set of correspondences is labeled Physical Symbolism of the Five Dhyani Buddhas. Dhyani is just a word meaning meditation. Dhyana, same word as Zen and Chan. The Sanskrit for it is Dhyana. And the Dhyani Buddhas are said to be meditation Buddhas in that you can focus on their form and on their attributes and go into a concentrated meditation on the five Buddhas. So hence meditation Buddhas. Okay, physical symbolism of these guys. And I don't track all of this, but some of it makes sense. Vairochana, empty space. Okay, sure. Vairochana is the subtlest of the five and the central Buddha. Akshobhya, water. Ratnasambhava, earth. And these are colored, of course. Blue water, yellow earth. Red fire for Amitabha. And green air for Mogasiddhi. Then they link the five senses. You can see how this chain of associations goes on and on. They link the five senses to those elements. So you have space as sight, water as sound, earth as smell, fire as taste, air as touch. That's a little less convincing for correspondences, but it does work. And then the physical, energy channels for Vairochana, space. Blood flow for water, that makes sense. Akshobhya is connected with blood flow. And kidneys, that's also liquid for water. Earth, smell, that makes sense. Flesh and spleen, why the spleen? Don't know. Amitabha, red fire, taste, body heat, okay. Liver, well, why liver? I don't know. Amoghasiddhi, air, touch function, and the inner winds, okay, the prana that circulates in the subtle body, and then lungs for ordinary air. Okay, that fills out the association pattern, and then it goes on. The mental symbolism is, of course, of special interest to us because we're trying to use these things for actual practice. So if we're going to contemplate these five, we work on the corresponding delusion. So Vairochana has ignorance, and again, the ignorance transforms into all-encompassing Dharmadhatu wisdom. And this is the avidya ignorance, the fundamental ignorance, I think. No, it isn't. It's the moha. Anyway, one of those two ignorances transforms into all-encompassing Dharmadhatu wisdom. I think it's the avidya ignorance that's meant here. Then akshobhya, for anger and hatred, transmutes into the mirror-like wisdom, like making a mirror of whatever's going on. There's a kind of clarity behind anger, or so they say, that when you get angry, there's that moment of, you're in the present, and there's a kind of clarity behind the anger. So if you can dissolve the anger, you get the clarity, and that's the mirror-like wisdom. And likewise, the last thing to go in Buddhist practice, they say, is pride. You know, there's quite a few kinds of pride, and pride is very tricky. I'm so damn humble, right? So pride takes a lot of work. And when it's dissolved, you get the wisdom of equality, the realization that all sentient beings have equal value. They all have the Buddha nature. So things that seem to have hierarchy are seen to have an equality attribute as well. Then Amitabha, desire and lust, all discriminating wisdom. If you discriminate thoroughly whatever the object of your desire is, you'll discover that it has as many unattractive features as it has attractive features, that they're both in play. And so that way you curb the desire. Don't go running madly off of this or that, after this or that object, because they are basically not going to be satisfactory in the long run. You know, the joy will gradually disperse because it's impermanent. That doesn't say that there aren't things that are desirable. Likewise, there are things to get angry about. It's a matter of getting control of these five primary poisons, as they're called. You know, greed, hatred, and delusion are the three primary poisons, and then you add pride and jealousy and envy to those, and you get the five poisons. So, Amoga City, then, jealousy and fear are the delusions, and the solution of those delusions is all-accomplishing wisdom. In other words, get busy saving sentient beings. I should mention, during major mandala empowerments, they have a mandala in front of the teacher, and there's a stick with feathers on it, kind of like a badminton shuttlecock. And each person in turn goes up to the throne and holds the stick over the mandala and then drops it. And the mandala will fall one way or another. So, that fell to Amitabha in the west. You know, that fell to Akshobhya in the east. That one fell to Amoga City. And the uncanny thing for me personally is about three-fourths of the time it came up Amoga City. So I assume that I'm in the Buddha family of Amoga City. There are five Buddha families. Everybody belongs to one of them. Partly, you can discern a little bit which your Buddha family is by thinking about which of the delusions is the worst in your case. You know, or in other words, if you're a greed type, Amitabha is your meditation Buddha. Likewise, if you're a hate type, it's Akshobhya. So I must be an envious and fearful type because my family seems to be that of Amoga City. Oh, good. Okay, on the next page are the symbols of the families, and I should show you this. I'll even pass it around. This is a Vishvavajra, a cross vajra ritual implement, and it's the symbol of Amoga City. So one came to me exactly because of that. Thank you. So we have the five Buddha families, and we all belong to one of them. And sure enough, then there's a seed syllable. Mantras all have seed syllables. Each deity has a mantra, and there's a corresponding seed syllable. So Tara has the seed syllable Tam, and Chenrezig has the seed syllable Hri. Ratnasambhava has the seed syllable Tram. Amoghasiddhi City has the seed syllable Ah. So these are the corresponding syllables to the five families. I don't know anybody in the Wheel family. Those are, you know, people that have arrived at Buddhism, at Buddhist enlightenment, I would guess. A lot of people are in the Akshobhya camp, the Vajra camp, because there's a lot of hate. Hate transformed becomes wisdom. So the principle is you take these poisons and apply the Dharma to them, and the result is they transmute into the corresponding positive structure. So likewise, using the jewel, Ratnasambhava transforms into the wisdom of equality, again, because we're all equal after all. You know, we're in these fleshly bodies. We all wish for happiness and sow the seeds of misery and so on like that. So we're all linked, we're all equal in those senses. The lotus family with the Hri transmutes greed, and that one is very popular in the Mahayana world, as I said. The I guess you could say that the mass of the populace have greed as a primary feature. Certainly in this country it is, you know, we're constantly hyped with get this, get that, acquire that thing, acquire that other thing. Mm-hmm. So Amitabha is definitely a significant Buddha for this world. Go ahead.
With the syllable Tram, you know, but the other syllables I've encountered numerous times in numerous mantras, etc., but Tram, not so much. What's the story behind that, and what does it mean?
Well, it partly means, now the Ratnasambhava figure is linked to the human realm, and I don't know why it's underemphasized, but it is consistently. Maybe we take it for granted because we are humans. There are a lot of seed syllables. Tram is one that's seldom used. There is a mantra over here somewhere, yeah. Ratnasambhava Tram is Ratnasambhava's mantra. So they often end a mantra with the seed syllable of the deity in question. So you have Om Mani Padme Hum Hri for Chenrezig, because Hri is the mantra of the Buddha family, the seed syllable. So Tram is obscure, but there it is. Amitabha is linked to the hungry ghost realm.
Really?
Yeah. Amoghasiddhi is linked to the Asura realm.
I always associated Amitabha as passion. You're transformed passion into discriminating awareness. Wisdom.
Yes, that's right.
And then the other one is more Ratna.
Yeah, the passion is right for the lotus, transmutes into discriminating wisdom. The the pride is the feature of Ratnasambhava, and that's transmuted into the wisdom of equality. And, you know, this is complicated enough, that's why I do handouts, so that you can refer to them without having to try to write down 10 things in a row and not miss one.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, aspect of passion, then?
Pride?
Yeah.
Greed and passion are related, yes.
Related. Okay.
And then pride and arrogance are related. And likewise, envy, jealousy, and fear for Amoga Siddhi. So what you've got is a concise structure that you can hang all kinds of different correspondences onto. And again, that's a major feature of the Tantra in general. You have all of these associations with things. Now, the famous five skandhas are again linked to the five Dhyani Buddhas. And you might think it's because there are five of each, but actually that correspondence makes a fair amount of sense. Form is linked to Vairochana. And that's the appearance of things. Consciousness is linked to Akshobhya. That's the dualistic consciousness. Again, the mirror. There are two things, the object and the mirror. So likewise with consciousness, with the lower mind, as I call it, with the discriminating mind, the yes and no, is and isn't mind, the dualistic mind, is linked with Akshobhya. And in fact, the wisdom that Akshobhya can generate overcomes that dualism of subject and object. Ratnasambhava is linked with the feeling, sensation. That's the primary emotional structure. Sensation, Vedana, is defined as the immediate reaction to a single sense impression. So you either like it, you don't like it, or you don't care. And then there's the next moment and the next sense impression. And again, you like it or you don't like it or you don't care. And on that structure is built our entire emotional life, which is not much mentioned directly, but that's the origin of it. So again, this is the human realm, Ratnasambhava with his wealth and potential arrogance transmuted into equanimity and equality. Amitabha is linked with perception, recognition, and with meditation. I'm not sure how to justify that particular association, so we'll let it go. Amoga Siddhi is connected with samskaras, the impulses to act, the 51 karmic formations that are the fourth skanda. So that makes sense, since Amoga Siddhi is about action in the external world.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Go ahead. With that part.
Yeah.
On the vehicles, I'm not sure what a Garuda is.
Ah. Okay, we'll go through it. Why is the dragon on Vairochana? Why is Garuda on Amoga Siddhi? Garuda is the name of a giant bird. In China, it's called the Peng bird. And these birds are huge, and they eat dragons. They eat nagas as their primary source of food, except for the Bodhisattva Garudas who have sworn off nagas. Just like many of the Bodhisattvas here have sworn off meat. So Garudas are magnificent birds. there's another image, and that's of the birdman. Like in ancient Egypt, there's Horus, the hawk. He has a hawk's head and a human body. Likewise, these avian birdmen have bird heads but human bodies. So the Garuda can be like that as well. But the main meaning is of that huge flying bird. Likewise, peacock. The display, of course, of peacocks. It's very beautiful. And why exactly it's linked to Amitabha, I'm not sure. In the Western tradition, I think it's linked to Hera, who's the consort of Zeus, which segues me to the next bit, namely the consorts. Each of the five Buddhas has five consorts. And in Bonpo and Nyingma, they're very important because they represent the five elements. And so they're the material substratum of the whole business, you know, the material elements. And so that's considered to be a female energy, the earth, the way that the material elements are. And Vairochana has Vajradhatishvari space as the element. And Vajradhatu is the Vajra realm. It's related to the Dharmadhatu, only it's more outer. It's like it starts with the Dharmadhatu, and then the next realm is the Vajradhatu, so that's slightly denser, but it's still totally ephemeral, like empty space. Akshobhya's consort is called Lochana. I neglected to look up the meaning of the name. And the water element. So she's basically the principle of water. In the West, the elements also have beings associated with them. In the case of water, it's the mermaids, the undines. I think Niksha is the name of the chief of the undines. So again, this principle of correspondences making a web of meaning is very common in the ancient world and in the medieval world, but practically unknown in our world. We've forgotten all of that, and yet here it is. The advantage of Tibetan Buddhism is that it locked up in a museum culture behind the mountains for 1,000 years, the transmission of the Buddha Dharma. And many things were forgotten in 1,000 years. And then, boom, all of a sudden it's outed, and there's a diaspora of Tibetans, and they're reclaiming this ancient knowledge, you know, which had been out of circulation for 1,000 years. So similarly, some of the Western tradition is resurfacing as well. The Western tradition got persecuted practically out of existence by the worldly church. And the result is it's in fragments, and you know, when things go underground, there's a lot of gnarly things in the underground, so it picked up a certain amount of contamination from its long centuries of being underground, so it has to be basically cleaned up. You have all this questionable magic that goes on based on the Western tradition, or rather based on a distortion of the Western tradition. But here in the East, the Buddhist esoteric tradition is alive and well and transmissible. So unless your calling is to work on the Western tradition and try to get it clarified a little bit after its long exile, you know, that's a plausible calling. But our calling seems to be to receive the Buddha Dharma and make it into a Western artifact, so that it's transmissible. So that's, in my opinion, what the modern Western Buddhists are about. We're building Buddhism. We're building the cultural container.
And interestingly, though, now that the Tibetan building blocks are here, it jives with the native people that lived here all along.
Exactly. Because there's a deep tradition among Native Americans. It goes back to the ancient initiatic traditions.
Yeah.
So naturally, you expect some of it to be the same.
Shamanic, and what did you just said? You just used a different word. Anyway.
Yeah, shamanic tradition has an ancient pedigree, 17,000 years at least.
And these same five elements are exactly...
Exactly the same, yeah. And then there are cultural differences, of course. But, you know, that's the principle. The Dharma stays the Dharma and it's unchanging. But the cultural forms that it takes depends on the people that it's transmitted to. So you find in Chinese Buddhism, it's a completely different form than Tibetan Buddhism. You know, it's amazing, it's beautiful. Chinese Mahayana is a little bit endangered, but the overseas Chinese are keeping it going. You know, likewise, the Buddha Dharma in Tibet is deeply threatened, but it's kept alive in exile. So we're fortunate to have the opportunity to be exposed to this sort of thing. I'll run through the mantras for the Buddhas. Vairochana, Om Vairochana Hum. That's simple enough. So it's entirely legitimate to, in the course of contemplating these five figures, to use the mantra for each figure. So Om Vairochana Hum is Vairochana's mantra. Om Vajra Akshobhya Hum is Akshobhya's mantra, and of course Vajra is the symbol of Akshobhya. Om Ratnasambhava Tram, there we go. One use of the Tram syllable. And you notice these mantras all end in hum or end in the seed syllable of the deity in question. Now this Om Amidava Kri for Amidava is, you notice there's a picture there of Amitabha in that tanka. And the people that devote to that deity often use that mantra, Om Amidava Hri. So that one is quite common. The other ones are obscure. Om Amoga Siddhi Ahum. You know, Ah is the seed syllable of Amoga Siddhi. And they just tacked a hum on the end of it. And in fact, you can invoke any deity by saying, Om Ah, name of the deity, Hum. That's in lieu of knowing the actual mantra, but you can use it that way. Meanwhile, last one, yeah. There's a few more associations yet. Might as well go through them all.
Yeah.
We have time. So there are bodhisattvas associated with each of the five Buddhas. Vairochana has Samantabhadra, and Akshobhya has Vajrapani. Now we have a tanka of Vajrapani, it's rolled up, but Vajrapani is the fierce Buddha representing, or fierce bodhisattva representing the power of the Buddha. So you have love, wisdom, and power. Chenrezig represents the love, Manjushri represents the wisdom, and Vajrapani represents the power. So Akshobhya the Unshakable has a lot of power behind him. And that's how he can create a clear mirror of reality as it is. Now, Ratnasambhava has the bodhisattva Ratnapani. Pani just means in the palm. So it means jewel in the palm. Just as Vajrapani means Vajra in the palm. And indeed, Vajrapani is holding a Vajra in his palm and lifting it above his head. Ratnapani, I've never seen a picture of Ratnapani. But again, the Tram is obscure, so for some reason is the Ratnapani. Amitabha has Avalokiteshvara, Chenrezig, as its bodhisattvic reflex. And Amoghasiddhi has Vishvapani, which means one of these things in the palm. And it might be out like this, I don't know. There are other associations. I wrote a couple out here. They're also linked with the realms, the six worlds. The Akshobhya is linked to the hell realm, Ratnasambhava linked to the human realm, Amitabha to the hungry ghost realm, Amogha City to the Asura realm, and Vairochana to the god realm.
Wait a minute, can we do those five again?
Yes. Okay, the hell realm is associated with Akshobhya because his emotion is hatred. The human realm is associated with Ratnasambhava. Because the human realm has to do with pride and position and wealth and all of those things. Amitabha is associated with the hungry ghost realm because hungry ghosts are experiencing unfulfilled desire, frustrated desire. And Amitabha is the Buddha of desire. So the negative realm attribute of desire is that the desire is unsatisfied, so it's frustrating. The hungry ghost realm is difficult to live in, they say. The symbology is that the pretas, the hungry ghosts, have narrow little throats and small mouths and huge big bellies, and they never get enough. It's not possible in the hungry ghost realm to get enough of anything. So that's the reverse of greed, so to speak. And Amogha City is linked with the Asuras, the Titans, the anti-gods. And these are the beings that attack the gods of Sumeru, of the Mount Sumeru, trying to take the city of the 33, Indra's city, trying to take that by storm. And the four heavenly kings have a retinue army, and they fight the Asuras off. The Asuras lose every time. And since Asuras are jealous and extremely cantankerous, they very often at the end of their lives fall down into the hell realm, which is caused by the hatred. So the Asuras indulge basically in wrong action and get a wrong result. And Amogha City is about action, bodhisattvic action. Likewise, Vairochana is linked with the gods. That makes sense. The animal realm is not mentioned here. So I'll run through it again backwards. The god realm is connected with Vairochana, descends to the Titan realm, the Asura realm, associated with Amogha City, descends again to Amitabha, the hungry ghost realm, and then goes to the human realm, and Akshobhya's is the hell realm. So again, we've got Ratnasambhava. Now, let's see. This is an alternate list. Let's try the animals again. Akshobhya's animal is an elephant. That's the unshakableness part of Akshobhya's nature. Ratnasambhava is linked to the horse. And this goes way back in India, too. In India, they had a ceremony called the Ashva Medha. And they'd strap a wheel onto the horse as a saddle and set the horse loose. And whatever ground the horse covered in the day, they tried to make it do a loop, that was the land that was claimed by that ceremony. So the horse is linked up with the human realm, especially the royal human realm. Amitabha the peacock, well, again, peacocks are beautiful.
They can eat poisonous plants.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can they also fight poisonous snakes, or is that something else I'm thinking?
No, no, you're right about that. They're associated with snakes.
I think Garuda is as well associated with the snakes.
Yes.
And it bites the snake, and then the snake turns into a string of precious pearls.
Beautiful, yeah. Yeah, the In the case of the peacock, I saw a strange thing. One time I was feeding a peacock. I was working on a farm, and it was a peacock. And so I got to know the peacock fairly well, since I was feeding it. And one time I was sitting in the garden, and that peacock came up and started doing a dance. You know, I don't know what kind of dance it was, but it was a peacock dance. And it turned its body gradually in a circle and showed its feathers. But below that array of beautiful feathers was, in feathers, an image of a snake. So it was a camouflage device to drive off predators. If they show their tail, they look big, and then under the tail is the image of a snake. So that would scare predators off, thinking that there was an actual snake. So the peacock is linked with the snake, very definitely. Then the Garuda, the birdman, associated with Amoga City. The Garuda spans huge distances, you know, very rapidly. So again, the idea of compassionate action being ever extended, ever extensive. And then Vairochana has the lion. In fact, the visualizable image of Vairochana, it's a lotus. He's seated on a lotus on a throne, and the throne is held up by four lions. So the lion's roar of the Buddha is linked to the Vairochana figure. Then there's Pure Lands. We might as well end with paradise. How's that? Akshobhya's Pure Land is called Abhirati, the joyous. Ratnasambhava's Pure Land is called Srimat, the glorious. Again, these are obscure. Amitabha's Pure Land is called Sukhavati, not obscure. You know, Sukhavati is everywhere. There's Pure Land Sutras and so on. Amitabha is emphasized for some various reasons in the current Buddhism.
Wasn't Amitabha also Devachan?
Devachan is Tibetan for Sukhavati.
Oh, okay.
Same land, different languages. And then the Amoga City's Pure Land is called Karma Sampat, perfected good action. And Vairochana's Pure Land is called Gana Vyuha, densely arrayed. And again, Karma Sampat. Presumably there are descriptions of these Pure Lands somewhere, but I've never seen one. A lot of the features of the Buddha Dharma are very prolifically described, and other ones are obscure. So we wonder what densely arrayed, what that Pure Land would really be like. Because there's all kinds of descriptions of Sukhavati, of Devachan. You know, the Amitabha is there sitting on a full lotus, and the people born in that realm are born out of lotuses. So almost like mind...
Lotus-born.
Yeah, mind-born. So they're lotus-born. And then they say that for those that got to Sukhavati but had questionable karma as well as good karma, their lotus doesn't open for maybe 100 years. They can still hear Amitabha's speech, but they can't see the Pure Land until they've cleansed whatever karma it was that was causing the lotus to not open. But for the others, the lotus opens and there's Amitabha, and it's got to be an experience. Remember, these things, however, are images, the visualizations. What the reality is, well, start with white light, luminous emptiness. That's probably not a symbol. Enough said, I think.